Henry James's The Portrait of a Lady stands as one of the most psychologically penetrating novels of the 19th century. Published in 1881, this masterpiece continues to captivate readers with its exploration of personal freedom, choice, and consequence. The novel has influenced countless writers, from Edith Wharton to Colm Tobin, who wrote The Master, a fictional account of James's life. Even contemporary figures like Nicole Kidman have cited it as transformative. Kidman famously carried a copy during the filming of The Hours, drawing inspiration from Isabel Archer's journey. The book's cultural impact extends beyond literature. Its themes of female independence and the clash between American innocence and European sophistication continue to resonate in modern discussions of feminism and cultural identity. What makes this novel so enduring is its central question: what happens when a spirited young woman with grand ideas about personal freedom confronts the realities of a world designed to constrain her? At an old English country house called Gardencourt, three gentlemen enjoy afternoon tea on a perfect summer day. Mr. Touchett, an elderly American banker who has made England his home for 30 years, sits with his ailing son Ralph and their aristocratic neighbor, Lord Warburton. The house itself stands as a testament to old-world grandeur, with its weathered stone facade and meticulously maintained gardens stretching toward the Thames. Their tranquil scene, complete with delicate china cups and freshly baked scones, is interrupted by the appearance of a young woman, Isabel Archer, Mrs. Touchett's niece, who has just arrived from Albany, New York. Isabel immediately captivates the men with her natural confidence and keen observations. Her dark hair and animated expression mark her as distinctly American among the more reserved English setting. When introduced to Lord Warburton, she responds with charming enthusiasm, "Oh, I hoped there would be a lord. It's just like a novel." This innocent remark reveals both her romantic imagination and her American frankness, characteristics that set her apart from the measured responses expected in English society. Lord Warburton, struck by her refreshing manner and unconventional directness, later remarks to Ralph that she embodies his idea of an interesting woman, a comment that foreshadows the attention she will attract throughout her European adventure. Isabel's arrival at Gardencourt represents her first step into the wider world she has long imagined through her extensive reading. Raised in Albany after her father's financial ruin and subsequent death, Isabel developed an independent mind through unrestricted access to her grandmother's library, where she devoured everything from Shakespeare to contemporary American essays. Unlike her sisters, sensible Lillian, who married conventionally, and beautiful Edith, who followed a predictable social path, Isabel gained a reputation for intelligence that intimidated potential suitors. She possessed what James calls a great fund of life and an insatiable curiosity about the world, preferring direct experience to books, though her knowledge of life remained largely theoretical. England delights Isabel, like a child at a pantomime, her enthusiasm unmarred by sophistication or pretense. Gardencourt seems a picture made real, its rich perfection revealing a world that gratifies her romantic sensibilities with its brown ceilings and dusky corners, deep embrasures, and quiet light on dark polished panels. Every detail, from the ancient tapestries to the family portraits gazing down from gilded frames, feeds her imagination. She forms a fast friendship with her uncle, questioning him extensively about England, its constitution, politics, manners, and royal family, often asking if these correspond with descriptions from books. Her earnest curiosity amuses the older man, who finds her American directness refreshing after decades among the English. This initial section establishes the central tension that will drive the novel: Isabel's desire for independence and self-determination colliding with the social expectations that await her in Europe. Her entrance into this new world marks the beginning of her education, not just about society, but about herself and the consequences of the freedom she so highly prizes. Her romantic notions about European culture, formed through literature and imagination, will soon be tested against the complex realities of old-world society, where freedom often comes with invisible strings attached. Isabel's independent spirit quickly manifests in her refusal of Lord Warburton's marriage proposal. Despite his wealth, title, and genuine affection, she declines his offer, explaining she doesn't believe she would suit him and isn't certain she wishes to marry anyone. When her uncle questions this decision, Isabel insists she doesn't wish to marry presently, clarifying that her refusal isn't because she awaits someone better. This rejection perplexes those around her. Who would refuse such an advantageous match? Her independence is further tested when Caspar Goodwood, a determined American suitor, follows her to Europe. During their tense meeting in London, Isabel maintains her position. "I don't want to marry. I want to be free." Though she acknowledges his feelings, she insists he respect her wishes and give her space. Goodwood reluctantly agrees to leave, but predicts she will eventually marry someone else, which Isabel finds ungenerous. Isabel's life transforms dramatically when her uncle dies and leaves her a substantial fortune, £70,000. This inheritance, secretly arranged by her cousin Ralph, who wanted to put a little wind in her sails, gives Isabel the financial independence to pursue her ideals of freedom. Though initially oppressed by her sudden wealth, she concludes that to be rich was a virtue because it was to be able to do. The fortune becomes both liberation and burden. Ralph had imagined Isabel would use her wealth to soar far up in the blue, experiencing life fully before making any permanent commitments. Yet this same freedom attracts those who would use it for their own purposes. As Mrs. Touchett shrewdly observes, "A girl might be poor and have a certain charm, but to be rich and attractive, it was enough to make one dizzy." Isabel gradually reconciles herself to her wealth, incorporating it into her self-image as a part of her better self that enhanced her importance and even gave her a certain ideal beauty in her own imagination. The financial independence that seemed to guarantee her freedom will ironically become the very thing that compromises it. What makes this section so compelling is the psychological complexity James brings to Isabel's character. Her desire for freedom isn't merely rebelliousness, but stems from a genuine belief that she must experience life directly rather than through conventional paths. Yet her inexperience leaves her vulnerable to manipulation, especially by those who recognize that her idealism can be weaponized against her. The fortune that should secure her independence will ultimately lead to its greatest limitation. Into Isabel's world of newfound wealth and possibility steps Madame Merle, a sophisticated American expatriate whom Isabel meets at Garden Court during Mr. Touchett's illness. With her perfect social grace and apparent wisdom, Madame Merle quickly becomes Isabel's friend and mentor. Their philosophical discussions reveal fundamental differences in worldview. When Isabel insists that material possessions are merely external to one's true self, Madame Merle counters with her famous declaration: "There's no such thing as an isolated man or woman. We're each made up of some cluster of appurtenances." This seemingly abstract debate foreshadows the concrete choices Isabel will face. Through Madame Merle, Isabel meets Gilbert Osmond, an American expatriate living in Florence. Described as altogether above the respectable average, Osmond presents himself as a connoisseur who has renounced worldly ambition to live quietly, appreciating beauty and collecting art. His hilltop villa gives Isabel the impression that once you were in, you would need an active energy to get out, a warning she fails to recognize. She becomes increasingly fascinated by Osmond, who strikes her as unlike anyone she's known, a specimen apart, with his fine grain, delicate features, and fastidious taste. What Isabel doesn't see is the calculated manipulation behind these introductions. In a private conversation, Madame Merle reveals her true purpose to Osmond. "I want you, of course, to marry her." Their scheme targets Isabel's fortune, with Osmond instructed to charm the wealthy American heiress. The Countess Gemini, Osmond's sister, recognizes this plot immediately, warning that Madame Merle and Osmond together are dangerous, like some chemical combination. Osmond begins visiting Isabel frequently at Palazzo Crescentini, calling 5 times in a fortnight, a stark contrast to his usual twice-yearly visits to Mrs. Touchett. When he finally declares, "I'm absolutely in love with you," Isabel is moved despite herself. His words bring tears to her eyes, creating the dread of having, in this case too, to choose and decide, a dread intensified by something within herself, deep down, that she supposes is inspired and trustful passion. After traveling extensively for a year, Isabel returns to Italy and accepts Osmond's proposal, despite the objections of everyone who cares for her. Ralph is devastated, telling her she's choosing a cage, while Isabel maintains she's satisfied with her decision. When Ralph suggests she once valued liberty above all, Isabel replies that having seen life, it no longer seems such an inviting expanse. She believes one must choose a corner and cultivate that, rather than attempt to survey the whole field. The irony is crushing. Isabel, who prized her independence above all else, has chosen the one man who will systematically destroy it. She has mistaken Osmond's carefully constructed persona for authentic character, believing his apparent indifference to society masks a noble spirit, when in fact it conceals a profound obsession with appearances and control.
3 years into her marriage, Isabel's life has transformed into something she never imagined. The narrator reveals that Osmond's egotism lay hidden like a serpent in a bank of flowers. His contempt for the world was not indifference, but obsession. He couldn't live without society's recognition of his superiority. While Isabel's notion of aristocratic life meant the union of great knowledge with great liberty, for Osmond, it was altogether a thing of forms. He expected her intelligence to operate altogether in his favor, her mind to be his, attached to his own like a small garden plot to a deer park. Isabel now understands that Osmond married her for her money and the social position it could bring him. Her resistance to his rigid system has revealed his scorn. The real offense was her having a mind of her own at all. She recognizes that Osmond now hates her for the revelation that she could dispense with him. The marriage has become a performance of perfect harmony for the outside world. Osmond speaks constantly in terms of we and us to visitors, while privately treating Isabel with cold disdain. Their Roman residence, Palazzo Rocconera, literally Black Rock Palace, symbolizes their marriage, imposing and impressive from outside, dark and suffocating within. Isabel's stepdaughter Pansy becomes both a source of genuine affection and another means for Osmond to control his wife. Raised in a convent and trained to perfect obedience, Pansy appears to be a blank page, a pure white surface, successfully kept so, with neither art, nor guile, nor temper, nor talent, only two or three small exquisite instincts, for knowing a friend, for avoiding a mistake, for taking care of an old toy or a new frock. Yet this tenderness makes her touchingly vulnerable, an easy victim of fate, with no will, no power to resist. When Lord Warburton reappears and shows interest in Pansy, Osmond sees an opportunity to advance his social position. He pressures Isabel to use her influence over Warburton to secure the match, telling her to think that over in a manner that reveals his true nature. Isabel is horrified by this manipulation, but torn between her growing sympathy for Pansy's secret love for Edward Rogier and her obligation to her husband. The disintegration of Isabel's marriage represents the novel's central tragedy, the collapse of her ideals under the weight of reality. The freedom she so prized has become a distant memory, replaced by the daily performance of a role she never wanted. Yet even in this gilded cage, Isabel maintains her dignity and moral clarity, refusing to become what Osmond wishes her to be.
Isabel's understanding of her situation deepens when she accidentally witnesses an intimate moment between Osmond and Madame Merle. Their posture and mutual gaze suggest a familiarity that creates a fleeting but disturbing impression. This glimpse behind the facade begins to unravel the web of deception surrounding her marriage. Madame Merle's true nature gradually reveals itself through her increasingly transparent manipulations. When she urges Isabel to use her influence over Lord Warburton to secure his proposal to Pansy, Isabel questions how she knows of this influence.
Madame Merle reveals that Mrs. Tichette told her about Isabel's rejected proposal from Warburton, suggesting Isabel make reparation by helping him marry Pansy instead. The final revelation comes from the Countess Gemini, who can no longer bear to see Isabel deceived. With strange exultation, she discloses that Pansy is not actually Osmond's child with his first wife, but rather his illegitimate daughter with Madame Merle. The entire story of Osmond's first wife dying in childbirth was fabricated to cover this truth. When Isabel asks why Osmond never married Madame Merle, the Countess replies simply, because she had no money. This disclosure transforms Isabel's understanding of everything that has happened since she met Madame Merle. She realizes that Madame Merle had married her, orchestrating the entire relationship with Osmond to secure Isabel's fortune and ensure Pansy's future. In a devastating confrontation, Isabel asks Madame Merle, "Who are you? What are you? What have you to do with my husband?" Madame Merle's chilling response, "Everything," confirms Isabel's worst suspicions. Isabel also learns from Madame Merle that Ralph was responsible for making her wealthy. It was his idea to convince his father to leave her the fortune. This knowledge adds another layer of complexity to Isabel's situation, as she realizes that Ralph's well-intentioned gift inadvertently led to her unhappy marriage. These revelations force Isabel to confront not just the deception of others, but her own role in creating her circumstances. Her pride in her judgment, her belief in her ability to see clearly, her confidence in her independence, all have been shattered by the reality of her situation. Yet this painful knowledge also offers the possibility of growth and a clearer understanding of herself and the world. Isabel receives word that Ralph is dying at Gardencourt, and she feels compelled to see him one last time. When she tells Osmond of her intention to travel to England, he forbids it, seeing her desire as a direct challenge to his authority. This moment represents a crucial turning point. Isabel must choose between her obligation to her husband and her love for her cousin. After learning the truth about her marriage from the Countess Gemini, Isabel's resolve strengthens. "Ah, I must see Ralph," she declares, her decision made. She defies Osmond and departs for England, knowing this act of independence may forever alter her marriage. The journey to Gardencourt becomes a kind of pilgrimage for Isabel. Throughout her long travel from Rome, she moves in a state of mental vagueness, unable to question her future or take pleasure in the spring landscapes passing by her window. Her mind wanders through strange, dimly lit internal territories, filled with disconnected visions and sudden gleams of memory. At Gardencourt, Isabel finds Ralph near death. Though initially unable to speak, he eventually rallies enough to have one final conversation with her. In this poignant scene, Isabel confesses she knows her husband married her for money, while Ralph tries to comfort her, saying he doesn't believe her generous mistake will hurt her for long. He describes how she was ground in the very mill of the conventional, despite her wish to look at life for herself. When Ralph asks if she's going back to Osmond, Isabel says she doesn't know, but will stay at Gardencourt as long as possible. In his final moments, Ralph tells her that pain passes, but love remains, and with his last breath, whispers that she has been adored. Isabel cries out, "Oh, my brother," in a moment of profound connection. Ralph's death marks the end of Isabel's innocence, but also offers a kind of redemption. By choosing to be with him in his final moments, she has reclaimed some measure of her independence and affirmed the importance of genuine human connection over social obligation. His unconditional love provides a stark contrast to the cold manipulation of her marriage, reminding her of what is truly valuable in life. After Ralph's funeral, Isabel remains at Gardencourt, telling herself it's common charity to stay with her aunt, though she knows she needs a good excuse for delaying her return to Rome. She thinks of her husband as little as might be, feeling a spiritual shudder when Rome comes to mind. She postpones deciding what to do next, and Osmond sends no word, leaving the choice entirely to her. This liminal period at Gardencourt represents Isabel's opportunity to reimagine her future. Will she return to the gilded cage of her marriage, or will she choose a different path? The question becomes more urgent when Casper Goodwood appears at Garden Court, having learned from the dying Ralph that Isabel is unhappy. In the novel's climactic scene, Goodwood confronts Isabel with brutal directness, declaring, "You're the most unhappy of women, and your husband's the deadliest of fiends." He urges her to leave Osmond and come with him, offering himself as her salvation. "We can do absolutely as we please," he insists, asking if they were born to rot in misery or born to be afraid. As he speaks, the world seems to open around Isabel like a mighty sea, where she floats in fathomless waters. The help she had wanted has come in a rushing torrent, and she believes that letting him take her in his arms would be the next best thing to her deepest desire. When Goodwood kisses her, like white lightning, a flash that spread and spread again and stayed, Isabel momentarily surrenders to the passion she has denied herself. But when darkness returns, she is free. She darts away toward the house, knowing now where to turn, a very straight path. 2 days later, Goodwood learns from Henrietta Stackpole that Isabel has already left for Rome. The novel ends with this ambiguous departure, leaving readers to interpret Isabel's choice. Has she returned to Osmond out of duty, or has she found a new kind of freedom in choosing her own fate, however difficult? Does her return represent defeat or a more complex victory, the triumph of moral responsibility over personal happiness? This ambiguity is central to the novel's enduring power. James refuses to provide easy answers to the questions he raises about freedom, choice, and responsibility. Isabel's decision to return to Rome may represent a kind of defeat, but it also demonstrates her moral growth, her recognition that freedom isn't simply doing whatever one wants, but accepting the consequences of one's choices. The Portrait of a Lady traces Isabel Archer's journey from innocent American girl to a woman with a complex understanding of freedom and its limitations. Her initial belief that independence meant avoiding commitment evolves into a recognition that true freedom includes responsibility for one's choices and their consequences. Isabel's transformation is reflected in her relationships with the novel's three principal male characters. Lord Warburton represents conventional society and its values: wealth, position, respectability. His proposal offers Isabel security and status, but would require her to conform to expectations she resists. Casper Goodwood embodies raw passion and American directness, a force that both attracts and frightens Isabel with its intensity. His final offer represents another kind of escape, one that would free her from Osmond but bind her to a different kind of obligation. Gilbert Osmond initially appears to represent Isabel's ideal, a man who has transcended conventional values to live for art and beauty. His apparent indifference to society masks a profound obsession with appearances, making him the most conventional character of all. Through her marriage to him, Isabel learns the difference between surface and substance, between the appearance of freedom and its reality. The novel's supporting characters offer different models of womanhood that contrast with Isabel's journey. Henrietta Stackpole, initially presented as fiercely independent and unconventional, ultimately marries and settles in London, confessing herself human and feminine after all. Madame Merle, who appears to have mastered the art of living well in society, is revealed as morally bankrupt, having sacrificed genuine connection for social advantage. Pansy Osmond, raised to perfect obedience, demonstrates that apparent docility can mask quiet strength and determination. By the novel's end, Isabel has lost her fortune, her illusions, and much of her youthful confidence. Yet she has gained something more valuable, a deeper understanding of herself and the world. Her decision to return to Rome, whatever its motivation, represents a choice made with full awareness of its implications. She is no longer the naive girl who believed she could stand outside society and its constraints, but a woman who recognizes that freedom exists within limitations, not in their absence. The portrait James creates is not static, but dynamic, a character constantly evolving through experience and reflection. Isabel's story reminds us that true growth often comes through suffering, and that the most valuable freedom may be the ability to choose one's obligations rather than avoid them. In this way, The Portrait of a Lady remains not just a masterpiece of literary realism, but a profound meditation on what it means to be truly free.